The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So for today's talk, I would like to discuss something about the Buddha's teachings on love and how for the Buddha it seems that love could be a vehicle for liberation. And rather than holding liberation apart from love, which sometimes in the Buddhist tradition it's done, it seems that there are times when the Buddha really kind of have these two big streams of Buddhism come together. One supports the other. And as a beginning to this, I'd like to mention that many years ago, I went to a symphony in San Francisco. And it was kind of unusual for me to be there, so I guess I was a little bit maybe excited or something. And the orchestra started playing its music, and I was kind of like on the side looking down, so you could see pretty well what went on in the orchestra. And I noticed after, I don't know, halfway through the first half, that I wasn't really listening to the music. I was thinking a lot about things. And I was thinking a lot about, especially about what was going on in the orchestra pit. And I was, you know, studying it and looking at this and that, and the trombone this and the drummer that. And I wasn't really taking in the music because I was involved in all the thoughts I had about what was going on. And I was there to listen to the music, I thought. So after a while, in order to, and I tried, you know, to get back to the music, and I kept going back to my thinking. So finally, I closed my eyes. And with my eyes closed, then I could get into the music. I could allow the music to come through me. And after a while, the music became the predominant occupation of my mind. And by the second half of the concert, I could keep my eyes open just fine. That busy thinking mind had settled down, and I could just hear fully. So meditation is, anyway, this is the same way, that there's a very important shift that needs to happen in meditation, where we're no longer so preoccupied with thinking that it interferes with our ability to allow something other to happen. There's a lot that can happen in our life that can't happen very well if we're preoccupied, caught up in our thoughts. We can't listen to the music very well if we're caught up in our thoughts. We have to let that quiet down enough. Doesn't mean we stop thinking entirely or dismiss thinking. It's just that we're at the concert to do something different than to think. So listening to a friend, you know, if you're just caught up in your own thoughts, you can't really listen to your friend. So meditation, if you're caught up in your thoughts, then you can't really avail yourself of the other aspects of our human life that are interfered with, not interfered with, but blocked out if we're always caught up in our thinking. Some people live so much in thoughts, in thinking about things, that it's really a foreign idea to them that there'd be anything else, any other way of relating to the world. And so it just seems like it's kind of a nihilism, annihilationism to stop thinking. You know, why would you want to do that? It's boring, you become less of something. But in fact, when we can get our thinking to abate enough, to quiet down enough, so it's no longer our preoccupation, then our inner eye, or, you know, we could see more clearly what's going on here, and we allow for a certain kind of inner beautiful states to arise and bubble up within us. Some of the most beautiful human states, to really feel them well, you can't be fixating or focusing on your thinking, because then you can't feel them. So love is one of those things. And that in order to experience love in the way the Buddha talked about, and to really to use it as a stepping stone for liberation, our preoccupations of the mind, our thoughts and concerns, have to abate enough so that we're not keep slipping into thinking about them, worrying about things and planning about things, and judging things and criticizing things and, you know, fantasizing about things. And we have to lose interest in the world of thinking enough to focus on this other deeper process, in this case, love. Just like you have to lose, I had to lose interest in my thinking in order to really listen to the symphony. And, that doesn't seem like a bad trade-off, right? You know, you pay a lot of money for a ticket. In my case, I was given a ticket. But still, you pay a lot of money for the ticket. And, you don't want to miss the concert by thinking, you know, being so interested. My thoughts are so interesting. They're the best. If someone says, put those thoughts aside for now, we're not troubled. But sometimes when we say put our thoughts aside during meditation, there can be inner rebellions. You know, oh, this is so important. What are these people telling about them? They'd be less of a human being if I don't, it's not any different than going to the symphony in that sense of willingness to focus on something else. So in this journey, I'm going to take you into what the Buddha talked about love. I'll take you back to his time, to a story of two Brahmins who came to see the Buddha. And the Brahmins were a kind of priestly caste at the time who, one of their big concerns, seemingly, especially these two, was somehow to be reborn in the presence of Brahma. Brahma being kind of one of the ultimate gods, the highest gods in the pantheon. And so they came to the Buddha because they had a disagreement. They both had different ideas about the path to coming into the presence with this ultimate god. So this is an ancient world, and how to make it relevant for us, I don't know, but one idea came to mind is that there are people here in the West who want to meet God. And different people in kind of theistic traditions have ideas. How do I meet God? How do I come into the presence of God? And some people focus on the afterlife. You have to behave a certain way in this lifetime. You have to believe in certain things in this lifetime. And then you can get reborn in heaven where you can perhaps hang out with God. And then other people who are more mystics will say, the way you meet God is more mystical, is more intuitive, is more something in your experience here and now. Some change of mind, of consciousness here allows for some kind of presence of God that's immediate. So here these Brahmins were asking, how do we encounter, how do we meet Brahma? And it seems that what they were thinking about was how to be born in his presence, which was kind of an ultimate thing to do, kind of ultimate goal for their religion. They were disagreeing about how to do that, and because they disagreed, they said, well, let's go ask the Buddha. So they went to the Buddha and they said, we disagree. Not only do we disagree, but there's a lot of other Brahmins in our community, and they all disagree as well. They all have different paths for how to do that. You know, so you can imagine, there's a lot of different paths to God. There's a lot of different theistic traditions who have different teachings, and they say there's different paths to it. So how do you know which one's right? Is it the Protestants? Is it the Mormons? Is it the Catholics? Is it the Jews? Is it the Muslims? You know, who has the right way? And do they all lead to the same goal? Was the question was asked of the Buddha. And there are people who would like all religions to have the same goal, all pointing to the same ultimate reality, ultimate thing. And so it's, this question, do they all lead to the same place? So the Buddha then, in the beginning of his reply, says something that's maybe a little bit, quite a bit challenging to them. I think maybe perhaps to kind of to pull away their certainty about what they're asking about. Because he says something like, have any of you ever encountered Brahma? They said, no, we haven't. Have your teachers ever encountered Brahma? No, our teachers haven't. How about your teacher's teachers? And how about your teacher's teacher's teacher? And the Buddha kind of went back through time, and they said, well, how about those original sages back in the Vedic times who composed the sacred texts about Brahma? Did they encounter Brahma? Did they actually meet Brahma? And they were like, no. And maybe one of the reasons they can be so confidently say no is that Brahma was met after you die. And since the people who, all those people, you know, they're actually known, they were known before they died. So what happened after they died, no one really knew. And the people who composed the text were still alive. So he's being cast some doubt upon the authority upon which people hold their beliefs. And that's a very, very powerful thing to do, a very significant thing to do, is to begin questioning, why do we believe what we believe? On what authority, and what scripture, and what teachings? And so something like as central as Brahma or God, which people orient their life around, is it intuitive kind of sense, oh yeah, there's such a thing? Or is it based on, you know, what's it based on? So here the Buddha is kind of beginning to challenge them a little bit. And so they admit, and none of those people actually knew directly what they were talking about. And then the Buddha said, it's kind of like a person who says he's fallen in love with the most beautiful woman in the country, but he doesn't know her name, doesn't know where she lives, doesn't know, you know, what she looks like, and has never met her, but has completely fallen in love with the most beautiful woman in the countryside. Now, if to fall in love with the most beautiful woman in the countryside without even having a clue who she is or where she is or what she looks like, what she sounds like, or anything about her, is that foolish? And the Brahmin says, oh, that's foolish. And so here, I guess the Buddha's kind of like really pulling the rug from under them. And these Brahmins apparently were game to this kind of way, so they hung in there. And then he had. Then Buddha gave a few analogies around crossing a river. He said, if you stand on one side of a river that's full to the brim, so quite deep river, you can't just walk across, and you stand on one side of the shore and look at the other side of the shore and wish the other shore to come to you, is that other shore going to come to you? And then no. So somehow wishing that something's going to come to you from outside was somehow not really what the Buddha was, you know, again, the Buddha's questioning, you know. And there are people who are waiting for grace. The shore is going to come to you. And then he said, what if a person wants to get to the other shore and lays down on the riverbank, on the side of the shore, and covers him or herself with a sheet? Is that person going to get across? No. Well, in the same way, if a person is covered by what's called in Buddhism the hindrances are actually the literal word for the hindrances in Pali is the coverings. If one is covered over by sensual lust, by ill will, by lethargy and dullness, by overexcitation, restlessness, and by doubt, then you're not going to get to the other shore. And here, the Buddha, other shore for the Buddha now was liberation. This shore is the shore of where we suffer, and to come to the place of liberation is to go to the other shore. And so our minds can be covered over, and as long as they're covered over with these kinds of preoccupations, we can't get to the other shore. And so the Buddha then says, you know, you have to at least kind of reduce these hindrances of the mind, these preoccupations of the mind, if you can understand what I'm going to talk about. And they asked him, these guys, do you know the path to Brahma? Do you know? You said all the other people don't know, for sure. Do you know? And the Buddha says very emphatically and confidently, I do. I know it as well as someone who grew up in a village knows all the roads in the village, how to walk around the village. Is that familiar? You know, yes, I know. So that's a pretty confident thing to say. So these Brahmins, I think, I imagine they've gotten, the Buddha's got their attention now. He's pulled the rug from underneath their authority. He's, you know, said all these variety of things. And so, he's going to tell them how it's done. So he says, well, first you have to settle these preoccupations of the mind enough. So the mind is no longer being pulled into its thoughts, concerns. So it's settled. So something different can happen, like you listen to the music. Something different can happen. You can be. And then, the Buddha said, once you've done that, then you begin filling the mind with love. With his heart filled with loving kindness, one dwells suffusing one direction, another direction, a third direction, the fourth direction, with loving kindness. Thus one dwells suffusing the whole world, upwards, downwards, across, everywhere, always with a heart filled with loving kindness, abundant, unbounded, without hate or ill will. It's quite a powerful statement about love. It doesn't say exactly how you cultivate it. The assumption is that you can tap into it from this state of meditation where the hindrances are settled and quieted down. And I found that one of the remarkable things about meditation for me was the way in which, as I got more settled, it seemed, or as the practice deepened for me, it felt as if the crusts on my heart faded away, kind of fell away. And meditation, mindfulness, is like the great tenderizer. And I was not looking for love and when I was doing my early long retreats, but as I sat there, it just kind of became something that started to radiate and became a very important reference point for myself and for how to live this life that we live here. And so as the mind settles down sometimes, we can tap into the capacity we have for love. Here it's called loving kindness. And then not only is it possible to feel it mildly or lightly, it's possible to strengthen it and develop it so it becomes a great power. So it becomes like rather than something that just kind of a little shy little flame in our heart, because something that kind of fills all of us. Here the description of suffusing, not only oneself, but there's a sense, a feeling that one's suffusing the whole world. The idea of suffusing the whole world, I don't know if it literally happens, but as we get concentrated, and as the mind gets very focused or filled with this kind of activity of love or focus on love, the sense of personal boundaries falls away. It's hard to kind of sense that I'm here and I stop here and the world's out there. And the sense of boundaries that we have, which is very important in some settings, is still something that's constructed. And that construction, that activity of making boundaries can fall away. And so there's a sense that this wonderful feeling is so radiant that it seems to radiate outwards in all directions everywhere. And to emphasize, what it really emphasizes here in this passage, that it's abundant, unbounded, unlimited, and without any hate or ill will. And then he says the same thing, and he says, just as if a mighty trumpeter were with little difficulty to make a proclamation to the four quarters, so by this meditation, by this liberation of the heart through loving kindness, one leaves nothing untouched, nothing unaffected. This is the way of meeting Brahma. So the Buddha has turned something around here. And this was a common technique of the Buddha, where he takes the terminology of other people and doesn't criticize it. He does give some critique here of the authority of which they have their belief, but he doesn't say Brahma doesn't exist. He doesn't question Brahma, question their goal. But he, I think somewhat cleverly, turns it around on them and redefines it. And rather than Brahma being something you attain when you die, you go to some heavenly realm, you meet Brahma in the state of mind that you have here and now. If you have a state of mind that is like Brahma, then you meet Brahma. So maybe a little more mystical kind of approach to meeting the God. Earlier in the discourse, the Buddha says to these Brahmins, he says, Does Brahma have any ill will? No. Does he have any... Let's see, go through. Is he impure or pure? And the Brahma says, oh, he's pure. Is he... Here the translation is, he's encumbered with wives and wealth. Is, I don't know about encumbered, but... You know, but anyway, you could ask that of God, right? Is God encumbered with wealth and wife, spouses? Is you know, are the great gods troubled by their sexual relationships? Zeus was, but he wasn't one of the great gods. In the Indian pantheon, Zeus would be considered a lesser god, and. So there's, in Indian pantheon, there's all these layers of heavenly realms. And as you get higher up in the heavenly realms, the beings become purer and purer. But when they're pretty low down and interacting with us mere mortals, some of them, you know, so they're kind of, you know, they're troublesome. And so, you know, apologies to Zeus. And So, then the Buddha asks these Brahmins, are Brahmins encumbered with wives and wealth or unencumbered? And so the answer from the Brahmins, maybe they're representing themselves, oh, the Brahmins are encumbered. Are they full of hate or without hate? Oh, they have hate, they reply. Are they full of ill will or without ill will? Oh, they have ill will. Are they impure or pure? They are impure. So, you know, I don't know about this, but if you don't take it so dramatic, the contrast, the question is, the issue is, Brahma, this great God, represents a very high degree of inner purity, where there would be no ill will whatsoever. And does that level of purity exist in the people in this world, the Brahmins, the priestly people in this world? And these Brahmins say, no, they don't have that, you know, they might be pure to some degree, they might have worked a lot of ill will out of the way, but we don't know any of these Brahmin, our colleagues, who are really free of hate and ill will, who really, you know, and look at them, they're all married, and they're all troubled by their spouse, you know, with the idea of spouses and this and that. And, So here the Buddha is pointing to the state of mind of Brahma, the state of his inner state. And the way to be reborn in the presence of Brahma, the way to be meet the Brahma for the Buddha, is not to do it literally, physically, but to do it by meeting that inner state. So to have the same state of mind, same state of heart as Brahma. That's where the meeting is. So there's a meeting of hearts rather than meeting of physical contact. So the Buddha is taking and turning around, redefining it in his way. Because the Buddha's emphasis over and over again was the inner transformation of the human being. That's what he was really concerned with. And so he said, great, I'll teach you a way to Brahma. And then he kind of turned it around and said, oh, this is how you do it, by doing this path of inner transformation that I teach. That's why he could say with great confidence, I know the way to Brahma, because he had redefined it. So then, and then this, I think, is the nicest image of this mighty trumpeter. So if you blow your trumpet, and then the sound carries in all directions effortlessly, you know, far into the distance. Now that my 11-year-old son is starting to learn the trumpet, I'm concerned about our neighbors. So mighty trumpeter were with little difficulty to blow all in all four directions. So by this meditation, by this liberation of heart through loving kindness, he leaves nothing untouched, nothing unaffected. So here the very key word, liberation of mind. The word liberation is vimutti. And Here the Buddha is saying that it's possible to attain a certain kind of liberation through love, through loving kindness. And exactly what kind of liberation is represented by liberation of mind through loving kindness is not so completely clear from the text. But it seems that there are plenty of passages in the canon where the Buddha emphasizes the use of loving kindness and compassion, sympathetic joy and equanimity, as vehicles and means to attain liberation. There's a passage in the Dhammapada where the Buddha says, a monastic dwelling in loving kindness and pleased with the Buddha's teachings attains happiness, the calming or the peace of all formation, the calming of all formations, the state of peace. The state of peace here in many places is referred to as Nibbana or full liberation. The Metta Sutta, the famous discourse of loving kindness, begins in order to attain that state of peace. And then it goes on and talks about a variety of things that are needed, but the heart of it is the cultivation of loving kindness. I think it's fair to say that for the Buddha, loving kindness by itself, love by itself, is not enough for liberation, but it's the main, it can be the powerful vehicle or the powerful kind of practice that can bring one to a very profound state of freedom. This is very different from a different path than the path of Vipassana, where Vipassana tends to be the path of not cultivating anything intentional, some particular state, but rather the path of just seeing very, very clearly what actually is, what is actually here in some deep way. The benefit of doing the path through loving kindness is that at some point, maybe not initially, at some point it becomes a very, very pleasant path to follow. And it's also, as the sense of love or loving kindness becomes stronger, becomes a stronger reference point, it seems to me that that there's a kind of mingling, commingling, or inseparability between a mind that is free and the mind that loves. And so what is it to be in this world, here and now? What is it to meet Brahma here? Is your neighbor Brahma? Can you meet Brahma in your neighbor, not because your neighbor is pure and filled with love, but rather because can we see the other beings through our eyes of love? Does how we see someone depend on who they are, or does it depend on the eyes with which we see? And probably it should depend on both, but a very significant thing that can happen as we begin learning, understanding our mind better and how it works, is we can actually start seeing how the shape, the color, the activity of the mind shapes how we interpret the world around us and others. And once we have a strong reference point for freedom, strong reference point for love, it's possible to see the world through that filter, through that reference point. And it becomes a different world. We see people very differently. I think that we become much more accepting of people because, you know, people don't need to be so different if we feel so complete, if we feel full and settled and at peace, then it's easier to just allow people to be who they are because they're not threatening to us. Part of the beauty of this very strong state of love is that it's a love, this kind of love that Buddha talks about, is a love that does not have desire as part of it. You know, like sensual desire, sexual desire, it doesn't have, you know, it's not like you want somebody, you know, I want that person, the most beautiful person in the country, that one that is for mine. There's no desire, that kind of desire doesn't exist in this kind of love. It's not exactly a relational transaction, which is what often goes into play when people are involved in love, popularly, at least in the songs we hear. And so, you know, I think for some people it can be a great surprise to discover first that there is love that can exist that doesn't depend on any kind of transaction, any kind of return, doesn't have any desire as part of it. It's an even bigger surprise, I think, at least it was for me, to realize that that can be so strong that it can be a provide a tremendous sense of stability and security as we go through this world. So I'll leave then, end the talk with a question for you. And the question is, if love, kindness, compassion, these things, are available to us, if they are significant vehicles for the path to freedom and liberation, how can you cultivate it? How could you develop it? How could you make it a stronger part of who you are? So that's a question for you. And we have 10 minutes. And I would like to learn from you. Would anybody like to offer some ideas of how, if someone is interested in cultivating this kind of boundless love that doesn't have any desire as part of it, how is it cultivated? So, Martha, is there a...
Hi. Ooh. I'm Martha, and I feel that in educational settings, they say if you want to be a better reader, then read whatever you can do, you know, at whatever level you're at. If you want to be better at math, do some math. And I think maybe if you want to be better at loving, then there are moments when we spontaneously do love without asking something back. And if we can notice those and celebrate those moments in ourselves, then maybe get stronger and happen more often.
Great, thank you.
My idea about this is if we just understand or realize that if we can feel love or compassion or kindness toward other people, we'll simply feel better inside than if we're scared of them or angry at them or perhaps even indifferent.
Great, thank you.
Loving kindness practice I tend to have a bit of a difficult time with, and I find that for me to approach it, I seem to do better using goodwill as a gateway to the larger, more expansive definitions of loving kindness.
Beautiful. Yeah, there's the English word loving kindness is one of the possible translations for the word metta. And you're certainly encouraged to find other translations, other words that they mean are more meaningful for you. Some people take out the love and just call it kindness. Some people take out the kindness and call it just love. Some people use goodwill. So whatever kind of word that speaks to your heart is the important thing. So over here, in the front here.
I use this mental trick where I practice meeting people as if for the first time without, all the baggage. And I do that with my husband. He's quite pleased with the results, actually. But I realized that I was carrying all that, those resentments and expectations, and that it was really affecting how I was meeting him. And other people too. So it's looking at the person with a very fresh fresh eyes.
Beautiful. Yeah.
This one seems really silly and trivial, probably, but I'll be driving down the street or something, and I'll notice someone will do something that I think is crazy in driving, or I'll notice someone that I criticize for some reason. And then I can slip into thinking, okay, I'm on a movie set, and everything here is exactly the way the director wanted it to be. And this person who cut in front of me, that's the way it's supposed to be. And this person who's walking across who isn't dressed right or whatever, no, that's the way it's supposed to be. And it just completely changes the way that I see the situation that I'm in.
Nice. I mean, there's a similar to that, there's a practice of seeing, imagining that everyone you encounter is a Buddha trying to teach. Everybody but one person in the world is a Buddha. And that one person is you, who's not. And they're all doing just the right thing to try to help you become awake.
Yeah. Same thing.
In the back there? Maybe if you can move one. Back there, maybe we'll move another one. There's two, right? Maybe have it ready over there in the corner.
I participate in a 12-step program, and one of the things I always struggle with is, as a Buddhist, is that, you know, they have all this God language. It's, you know, the official stuff is all very deistic. So I'm always trying to translate. But one of the instructions that they give, if you're like angry at someone, or particularly if you're feeling like you want to control a person, I get that energy going sometimes, is just abstain from doing anything and pray for them every day for 2 weeks. So then there's this question of, if you don't really believe in God in the usual sense, what's prayer? But I've actually found, and it was through, you know, like being in this 12-step program, and okay, they tell me to do it, I'll just do it. It doesn't really matter if you believe in God at all. As my main Buddhist teacher says to me, yeah, you know, prayer is just an attitude, you know. And I have really found that, you know, just praying for the well-being, I mean, after all, why should I be against the well-being for anyone? It does sort of soften me and get me less afflicted with whatever was, you know, bugging me in my relations with this person. So it's actually a very good tool I learned from this program.
So you do. So if you're really bugged by someone, you know, the last thing you can feel is any love for them, then you'll start doing it anyway, the prayer.
Yeah.
And then after some weeks of doing it regularly, then something shifts.
And, you know, it is very much like the metta practice.
Absolutely.
You know, you're supposed to get out to doing metta for Freddy phrases for the enemy. It's really the same thing.
Yeah.
And so I think it's great.
Yeah, Nicole.
For some time I've been using the Tibetan Buddhist practice of Tonglen, which is similar, but it gives you a visualization. And in this, it's best to start with yourself or a friend or family member, and you think of one thing to focus on, for perhaps, say, a person you know, a friend, their fears of something or another, and you visualize them filled with black smoke. And then with each breath that you take, you pump that smoke out of them until they're crystal clear. And the smoke you pump into a circle or a sphere in front of you. And then when they're clear of that, say their fear, black smoke in your mind, you breathe in that black smoke to your heart. And it shatters your heart, which gives this golden glow of light, which you imagine enveloping that person. So you start with friends or yourself or your family members, and then as time goes on and you become more adept at this, you can move on to your, you know, people who are troublesome to you, and then to your enemies. And it's a good visualization technique, and it's kind of like that sense of turning the energy around into a positive energy from the negative one that you started out with.
Beautiful. Thank you. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I can't let this go without suggesting to the people on the World Wide Web that we all gather at the corner of Haight and Ashbury and wish for the summer of 1969 to come back. Or was it 68? I think what you said about the hindrances was very important. The neighborhood discussion group literature talks about that, so that's an upcoming topic. And that seems to bear mention as a preparation.
Yes, thank you. So one more. Yes.
For me, it's not a theory. It's watch what happens. I simply have to observe. If I become angry and filled with ill intent towards someone, if I'm mindful enough, I see where that leads me, and it leads me in suffering. Great. And then if I am mindful enough to release that and let it go, then I see it leads me to no stress.
Beautiful. And then if you're mindful enough to notice those times in daily life where goodwill, kindness, love, even a small degree, is bubble up, and really notice it well, and then to validate it or support it is another way. So thank you very much. And there's one more way of cultivating loving kindness or goodwill or friendliness or whatever, and that is to stay and have tea. And meet some of the people here if you'd like. And those of you who might be new today, it's a bit daunting to come in here sometimes, when especially to come in, and we're all silent when you first come in, you know, at the beginning, and no one's talking, and then you have to go in here and sit down. What's going on here? And no one tells you. And so, so I know I realize that. And but now people will talk. And so, introduce yourself to someone and welcome to IMC.